This is a man that needs no introduction.
Who is this guy?
The most knowledgeable columnist in the city of Pittsburgh.
Some in our audience don't know the finer points of hockey.
He goes by only one name.
Hotter than Bond, cooler than Bullet. Shaft.
No, it's not Shaft. It's Rossi. And he's here right now on Trip Live Radio.
Well, as columnists go, Rob Rossi's a gunslinger. He ain't no dink and dunker. What kind of elements do you want from your quarterback at Paul Brown Stadium, Rossi, this weekend as you join us here on Football Friday, a Steelers Friday on Trib Live Radio? You want gunslinger Ben or you want dink and dunk Ben?
Well, I mean, I want Ben to get something done on deadline. So, I think dink and dunk Ben might give the Steelers a better chance of not being one and done, Ben, and also getting it a better chance of me getting a good column on deadline. So I'm going to go with dink and dunk, Ben. But
you selfish bastard. You're going for caution. This is unbelievable.
Well, I'm not going for caution, but I think there's a difference between taking what's given to you and trusting that that will be enough to beat what is probably going to be an A.J. McCarron-led Bengals team versus forcing some throws to Antonio Brown and getting impatient and allowing the Bengals to get opportunities that could lead to turnovers that could stem momentum. I think if the Steelers don't turn the ball over, they're going to win this game. I think if the Steelers turn the ball over once, they can win the game. But if you start throwing multiple interceptions, which Ben's done the past 3 weeks, the chances are you're not going to win the game. And the gunslinger is a great analogy, except that we only remember the gunslingers that win. People forget there's another gunslinger in those movies, and one of them loses. So they're not all John Wayne.
Who won the High Noon shootout with Gary Cooper, guy? Did he win that one?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's why I remember. All right, fair enough. Good point. All right, well, if that's the case, and they can dink and dunk. And
Jimmy Stewart won against Liberty Valance, too, but John Wayne shot him from the alley.
Guy and I just spent the entire commercial break looking at this flattened 1976 Steelers Super Bowl champions
beer can
I was talking about yesterday, Ken. Mm-hmm. And we just went through the entire Steelers roster here. Now, you guys have just gone through how many movies in the 1950s? How far back did you just go with some of your movie references there?
I think that was 1950. When did High Noon come out?
I don't know about you, Rob, but I'm getting the feeling that a lot of people, and Guy is one of them here in Pittsburgh, that, cover the team, root for the team, would like to see the team continue to win, are actually picking the Bengals anyway. I don't know where you fall in this. It sounds like you're a little bit more, leaning towards the Steelers. Is that the case?
Yeah, but only leaning. I think this is going to be a much different game than what a lot of people in terms of, it's the Bengals and the Steelers beat the Bengals and, the Steelers are in the Bengals' head. To me, if you look at that game in Cincinnati, it very much was what happened in Pittsburgh until the very end, which was the Bengals didn't allow the Steelers to score a lot of touchdowns. They seem to have figured out somewhat how they can keep the Steelers' offense in check. And the difference this time is A.J. McCarron's going to have had some experience under his belt, and he's going to have a game plan tailored to his skill set as opposed to Andy Dalton's. I think it's going to be a much harder game to win. I think the Bengals are going to treat this like their Super Bowl, and I don't think the Steelers will. I think this Steelers team, the sense I get, you guys might have a different one, is that they think there might be something bigger than the Bengals coming, and that not that they won't be up for this game, but for a team that has had at times trouble being up for games, I think they have some players on this team that think there's an opportunity here to get to a Super Bowl. Whereas the Bengals, I think if they win this game and they get blasted in the next one, they're still going to have beaten the Steelers. And I think that's going to be a big step for them. So, yeah, I think there's a real interesting dynamic going into this one.
In terms of Roethlisberger's year, Rossi, the way he's trended of late has not been good interception-wise, but he's had a pretty good year, right? I mean, by Pro Football Focus's metrics, he's the second-best quarterback in the league this year. Some others, I think, have put him lower, like top five. What do you think of Ben's year as a whole, and does it kind of depend on how he plays in the playoffs now, or can you just bottle up the regular season and say he was really good?
I think Ben is in the same category that Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin are, and to, I guess, a lesser extent, Andrew McCutchen, where, yeah, I've seen him do great things, but I'm going to judge them by the postseason. You know, I want to see it when it matters. And, you know, he at times this year was absolutely the best quarterback at football. Those times also seem to be, to me, the ones when Martavis Bryant was an option for the Steelers that made their offense almost unstoppable. And I think that's one of the reasons, I'm guessing, that Ben was so public with his criticism of Bryant, because he knows that if that guy's going, this offense is probably a giant windstorm away from being unstoppable. It's going to force another team to score 30 points. But they need Bryant to get back there, because that opens up everything. I mean, even without a running game, if Bryant is able to be in the game, engaged, a threat, not just a guy you're throwing the ball deep to, but a guy that makes a couple of plays here and there, it's not just opening up everything for Antonio Brown. It's forcing teams to single cover Wheaton and leave the middle of the field open for Keith Miller. I mean, it really allows the Steelers to be both a explosive offense and a possession offense with those receivers. But I think it all hinges on Bryant, and I think Ben's season is going to be judged by how he performs in this game, and I think largely that's going to be Bryant, too, because I think we've seen the last couple of weeks when Ben gets into trouble, it's because he's forcing the ball. And when he forces the ball, he's trying to look for Antonio Brown too much. So I think a lot of this depends on, does he have that option in Bryant?
Do you buy that the Bengals are going to come out running and that they're rarely going to attack the Steelers' secondary deep, as has been advanced by a number of people coming out from Cincinnati? Because I do, and if they do that, I think they're doing themselves a disservice, because I don't know why you wouldn't attack the Steelers' secondary.
I don't buy that, and there's not any conversation I've had with people who know Marvin Lewis that makes me think that he's not going to have A.J. McCarron take some shots down the field. I get the sense that the people who are looking at that way are buying into the old conservative Bengals and not buying into the Bengals have played the Steeler team twice. In each game, they've made big plays down the field. They think this secondary is a secondary that can be had at times, and I think they're going to take some shots. I'd be surprised if they don't take some shots early.
I think
they're going to have them throw 40 times, but I think they're going to take some shots down the field.
Well, what about the other way? What can you expect out of the Steelers running game? Will they have to pass for their running game?
I think the Steelers have to be committed more to the running game than they were in the wild card game last year. I don't know that it's a number as much as making sure you don't just get into Ben. You have to have that threat there. You have to have that possibility there of handing the ball off. I'm not saying they need 20 carries because, you know, if they get 10 carries on their first two drives and then 10 the rest of the game, that's 20, but that might not be what works for them. But they need to be committed to trying to run the ball. Against Baltimore last year, they got away from that real early, and it showed. And it allowed the Ravens to tee off. Now, the Bengals don't rush the passer quite like the Ravens did last year. But if you become one-dimensional, even if you're Ben Roethlisberger, and even if you got those receivers, you're still one-dimensional. So I think they have to be consistent with trying to run the ball, especially when they get inside the 25 to 30-yard line, because that's where the Bengals have really stopped them, and I think it's because the Steelers haven't been committed to running the ball in that area.
We had a report, Rossi. We're talking to Rob Rossi, our Trib columnist here on Trib Live Radio with Laird Junker and Benz. We had a report that John Perry, the same referee from the second meeting with Steelers and Bengals, is back for this weekend's game, and his whole crew on top of it. Do you understand this rationale from your National Football League?
Only in that it might make sense, given the heated nature of this rivalry, to have somebody who's been a part of it early. If you get a referee who hasn't been a part of it and a crew that hasn't been a part of it, then you have a situation where they're not as familiar. I think in the playoffs, I know this sounds hypocritical, There are some things I think you let go. I think you don't want a referee that's going to get in there and, you know, start making it a flag fest. So if he's been given the instructions to, like, look, there's going to be some pushing and there's shoving, but unless it gets crazy, we're not going to, you know, we're going to let these guys play a little bit. I would favor that. Now, here's the thing. I can't tell NFL officiating crews from quarter to quarter, let alone game to game. So I have no idea what to expect from the officiating crew just because there doesn't seem to be any consistency. It seems to have been a story all year in the NFL. You guys watch a lot more games than I do outside of the Pittsburgh games. Every time I watch a football game this year in the NFL, I come away thinking, man, this officiating is just, it's NHL-like with its inconsistency. It is, isn't it?
No, it is. And I'm glad you brought up the NHL because before you left, Rob, we wanted to ask you about Sidney Crosby not being on the All-Star team.
Yeah.
Your thoughts?
Doesn't deserve to be.
Well, I know he doesn't deserve to be, but Should he be on it anyway? I mean, this is just...
No.
It's such a clown show. Why not, if it's so made for TV and it's supposed to be 3-on-3, open ice, why not find out a way to get him on the team?
Well, I think what the NHL should have done is just overload on defensemen and only have like 6 or 7 forwards for the whole All-Star game. Because that's the way the coaches take the approach in 3-on-3 anyway, right? Look, Sidney's had a down year. I think he's starting to play a lot better. To be honest, I think Penguin fans should be thrilled he's not in there because it gives him the time to go away. If he's looking for a little bit of motivation, I guess that could be it. I don't know that the NHL views Sidney Crosby as the face of the game anymore. I think, and I said this for years, I think that's something that at the beginning of his career, it was all Alex, all Sidney, all Alex, all Sidney. And then really when the Penguins stopped winning championships and Alex Ovechkin still hasn't won one, they started turning to sort of marketing a bunch of different guys. And now they are kind of a faceless team. So I don't think they view him the way the Penguins view him, the way the people in Pittsburgh view him as the guy carrying the whole thing on his shoulders. And, you know, it's an American market. It's a non-traditional market that I'm not sure having Sidney Crosby in Nashville matters as much to the league as it would having him in Montreal or a traditional U.S. market where they really, really know who he is.
Could Kane have been that guy if he wouldn't have got into trouble? I mean, is that key?
Yeah, I think so. I think Patrick was going to be that guy. I mean, I think we tend to forget before the injury last year, Patrick Kane was going to win the scoring title. I think he was going to be the first American to win the scoring title and probably would have been the MVP of the league. He's probably going to be that this year. And I still think that there's a chance Patrick could be that guy. You know, if the Blackhawks win another Stanley Cup and, you know, he's a big factor in it again, I think if nothing has been proven in that case, or I guess not even a case anymore, those allegations, I think they could market him a little bit more. But the problem with marketing Chicago stars is, you know, the Blackhawks do a wonderful job of, you know, boring down their product. They don't, you know, Kane and Taves, you know, they're not the most exciting guys to the public after, you know, when they're not playing because they just, they tend to take on that approach all hockey players do of, you know, it's 82 games and we want to be focused for everyone and blah, blah, blah. If Patrick was allowed to be Patrick, it might be a little dangerous, but it also would probably be a little more exciting.
Well, back to the Crosby non-selection, Rossi. Did Letang deserve it?
No. No. That's what makes the All-Star game even more of a joke. That the fact that Chris Letang is in the All-Star game and the Penguins have two representatives is farcical. If you were going to take two Penguins, it should have been Fleury and Malkin. That Fleury's not in there shows just a complete lack of appreciation for where his game has gone to. I've said before, Marc-Andre Fleury is still being haunted by a bad series in Philadelphia where everybody else stunk to, and letting in a goal in the World Junior Tournament that Canada's not forgiven him for. Because to argue that he hasn't been one of the 6 best goalies in the league this season is folly, especially when the way the Penguins completely relied on him over the first 2 months of the season almost to win games.
Well, who got in from the Metro?
Chris Letang is what?
Who got in from the Metro? Who are the two goalies?
Corey Schneider was one.
Corey Schneider's been really good this year, but did Lundqvist get in? I'm sure Holtby got in.
Holtby. Yep.
I mean, the Penguins don't deserve two guys. I mean, even by his standards, Malkin's having a what he should have year. It's not an exceptional year. They're a ninth or tenth place team. I forget where they're at in the standings right now. They hasn't been in the playoffs for a month now, and they shouldn't have two players. But who cares? It's the All-Star game. The Penguins are better off having nobody go. And it's not something that anybody should make a big stink about. They should be. I would prefer people start focusing on, these last two games against Chicago and how instructive they were about what progress the Penguins may or may not have made than what's going on with the All-Star selection. When they're not even going to play hockey, it's going to be a shimmy tournament.
While we're on the subject of honors, how about Alan Faneca's chances this year in year one of the Pro Football Hall of Fame? He made the final 15 yesterday.
Not year one. I think it'll be a while. I think the next Steeler to get in is probably going to be Troy. So we probably got 7 years or five, guys?
It's five. I think. Yeah.
Five. Yeah, I think five. I think we're probably going to go a half decade at least. I think Troy has a chance to be a first ballot guy. I think Faneca was the best. One of the best guards in football when he played. It seems like it's really hard for guards to get into the Hall of Fame. I do think there is a bit of a Steeler bias in that I think there's just so many in there that it's hard for guys like Faneca to really, even if they had exceptional careers, to really have that case made for them because you've got other guys coming down the line. I mean, the Hall of Fame voters, and I was out there last year, I got to talk to a bunch of them. I got the sense about the Bettis thing is most of them always thought Bettis belonged in. They just thought, maybe Bettis had to wait a little bit. And it wasn't his time, I should say. Not that he had to wait, but it wasn't his time. You hear a lot of that it's that guy's time. It's that guy's time. The Hall of Fame committee knows they're going to have hard conversations on a guy like Hines Ward, let alone a guy like Alan Faneca.
That's where I disagree with the thinking. That's where you should put Faneca in over Hines. If Hines has to be measured on numbers because you measure receivers on numbers, then he doesn't get in and maybe his time takes longer. There's no numbers to measure a guard, and the guard, show me a guard that was better than Alan Faneca.
I agree. Tim, I agree. I to me, of the guys who are not playing for the Steelers right now, or not playing in the league, the guys that we saw in this second great era, it would be Troy Polamalu, then Alan Faneca. Those are the two best Steelers, and I think they both should definitely be Hall of Famers. Alan Faneca is a 6-time All-Pro. He's got more All-Pro appearances than anybody in the history of the Pittsburgh Steelers. First-team All-Pro appearances. He was an exceptional player at a position that they just don't let a lot of guys in. I would like to think Faneca would get in. To me, something that could help him is, I don't know a better case to make for Alan Faneca and what he did routinely than showing that run Willie Parker had. Because that run is more about Alan Faneca's blocking than it is Willie Parker's speed, or at least it's as much as, to me, in the Super Bowl.
And he did have one Pro Bowl year in New York, so maybe that'll help him, too.
Maybe. Look at it, guys. I mean, who do you got? You've got Polamalu, and you got Ben, and those guys are probably going to be locks. And we're going to get to the point now where we're one more season of Antonio Brown doing what he's doing before we have to start having that conversation. I'm writing about that in tomorrow's column about how maybe we should table that conversation until he does something in the playoffs. But, to me, there's another guy nobody talks about, and I know he didn't have a length of his career, but when all said and done with James Harrison, his peak was as good as any Steeler linebacker not in the Hall of Fame. And if you're going to seriously talk about If you're going to seriously have discussions about Terrell Davis, I forget how you say his first name, excuse me, for the Broncos, then you better have conversations about James Harrison because he was a monster in the postseason and he had two or three of the best defensive years a Steeler player has ever had.
Rossi, good stuff. Enjoy your trip out to Cincinnati. We'll be looking forward to the coverage.
Yeah, now I guess my prediction is I'll be talking at some point next week from Denver, so...
Take your rain bonnet.
Yeah, get your Patriots poncho that you bought in week one and take it out there with you.
I still have that, believe me. Nobody will enjoy a good heel run in the AFC title game like me, believe me.
Starts in the rain and ends in the rain. Thanks, Rossi.
Take care, guys.
Yeah, that scene with Rossi up at Gillette Stadium me, Rossi, and Caboli. Caboli had taken a poncho out of the trash and was wearing it, a black and gold one. Rossi went in and paid like $20 and put it on the Tribs dime for a Patriots poncho. They took a selfie, and the Twitter responses were obvious that followed on that one. Rossi with his heel turn. In terms of the Crosby All-Star Game thing, back to that for a second, guys. I didn't realize this before I was looking at Puck Daddy, that he hasn't played in one since 07. I mean,
right.
Not really his fault, I guess, but...
there's been injuries and the concussion, and there wasn't one year,
yeah.
Right? There
yeah,
wasn't
the Olympics,
a game.
One year. I mean, you would think now, because the fans voted for the captains, that's it this year. The rest of the squad was selected by the NHL team. So wouldn't the NHL want Sid to be there for face of the league?
I disagree with Rob there. I think yeah. They do, and I think the fans there do, too. I mean, you know, you still, you know, if you were a baseball, I always argued, you know, I didn't want to see Willie Mays hitting .229 in the All-Star game, but the fans wanted Willie Mays at the All-Star game when he was a Met.
Kobe yeah, so Bryant.
Perfect put him example. In over Letang. Like, if Letang hadn't made it, and they, I mean, maybe you could argue they
but
had
But you need a certain amount of defensemen. That's the problem. They had to put on a certain amount of defensemen. Where the argument runs into a brick wall is the formation of this stupid format in the first league.
Yeah.
in the first place from the league.
Don't knock 3-on-3. Did you watch Penguins box the other night?
No, I'm talking about how you're forming the teams. If you need X number of defensemen, X number of goalies, and X number of teams need to have a representative each, then you kind of... Now it really parses down how much you can argue the value of having Sidney Crosby there. I think Sidney Crosby should be there. I think they should prioritize it because, you know, it's a made-for-TV event and he's still a big-time draw. So put him in there.
The way the game's been played for 20 years anyway, you don't need defensemen even if they're playing 5-on-5.
Yeah, right. So why do you need
no penalties,
so
no hitting? Yeah. I mean, yeah.
That's part of the humor of this 3-on-3 format that they're putting. They've been playing 3-on-3 in the All-Star game for 25 years now.
2-on-2 sometimes.
If I'm not mistaken, the All-Star game in Pittsburgh in January of 90, was that?
At the Civic Arena? 90. The Lemieux won, and I think it was 90.
Yeah, the truck. He won the truck.
He won the truck in St. Louis.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, I believe that was the first All-Star game ever where there wasn't a penalty. So, it used to be a brutal game. It used to be the defending Stanley Cup champions played the rest of the other, you know, when it was original six, would play the other five teams' All-Stars. There'd be fights. It'd be a regular hockey game. So, I mean, I understand the way they're playing around, but I think you want your future Hall of Famers all gathered there, even if it's for photo ops, autograph opportunities, and hobnobbing. I'm sure Sid would rather go and fish or whatever he's going to do for 3 days or 4 days, but I disagree that, you know, that he's not needed or wanted there.
Even Henrik Lundqvist, I mean, like, he didn't make the team. You guys were talking about him. I don't know if that's a snub. Maybe he's not been playing that well this year. But don't you want Hank Lundqvist in your All-Star game?
Yeah, instead of Corey Schneider?
Yeah. I don't know what Rangers fans think about that. They got Ryan McDonagh in instead of him. But
if you're the person having a fantastic All-Star season and you get snubbed for an old guy who's beyond his prime or a former All-Star who's having a down year, you feel kind of there's room for everybody. Do you really need roster sizes? Bring the guys having a great year and bring the future Hall of Famers as well.
Yeah. Then I was looking back at this all-pro stuff because, you know, for whatever reason, the all-pro vote has all this prestige with the NFL Hall of Famers. Okay, it's 50 guys that vote on the top players at each position, and they announce a first and a second team. But they announce the first team based on who gets the most votes, and any leftover votes get a second team selection. So I'm not trying to knock Alan Faneca getting 6 first-team All-Pros, but there was one year where Jamal Charles and LeSean McCoy got the most votes at running back. They got almost all the votes. Eddie Lacy got one vote from some guy in Wisconsin, and he got a second-team All-Pro because of it, because everybody else voted for LeSean
That's
McCoy
why I'm not
Jamal
talking
Charles.
About second-team All-Pro. I'm talking, that's why I said from the beginning of the conversation, 6 first-team All-Pros from 50 astute football writers. That's significant to me.
This seems highly flawed in to put that much weight
from
on
from a guy who wants to read from Pro Football Focus for half an hour that self-admits that some plays they don't know whose responsibility it was, so they leave them out. You're going to call
this
flawed.
Well, what's wrong with that? at least they're watching the game. I know Bouchette's not watching Eddie Lacy games before he casts that vote for the best running back. Come on. Ed's great, but he's a great Steelers writer. He's not a great league voter. That is a flawed process. What do you think?
Nobody watches every game.
There are people that watch more games than others.
How do you know Ed doesn't go home and watch games on his cable like you do?
I know Ed doesn't go home and watch games on his cable. Come on.
Yeah, I know that too.
Yeah, you walked into that one, didn't you?
Ed would admit that. Ed would, I'm Ed not would watching glory. That. I'm going to the bar in Plum.
Come on, Ken. I'm not watching Titans Jaguars.
Like last year, for instance, okay, the first the all-pro quarterbacks were Aaron Rodgers and Tony Romo. Aaron Rodgers got 44 votes. Tony Romo got 3. So those are the only two quarterbacks that were recognized last year by all-pro. Is that fair? I guess. But it's a little elitist.
I don't think anybody needs to look at all-pro stats to judge a quarterback.
Steelers got Le'Veon Bell got first-team all-pro running back last year. That seems right. I mean, he had a great year. DeMarco Murray was the other one. So in some cases it seems to be on. In some cases, I've got my doubts.
Well, sure, yeah. You know, when you think it's on, you think it's on when it's a statistically proven position, and you have your doubts on a position where it's not, which is why I go to it for those, because there's no way of knowing.
Again,
you don't want, even if you were watching every game that a guard plays, you're not watching the guard every play.
How about Pouncey? Pouncey got first team center last year.
I'll bet most of these writers, and I think Ed would do this too, ask players too their opinion. Who's the toughest guy you went up against? I'm thinking of voting for one of these two guys for. I mean, they have relationships like that. I would think anybody that doesn't take it seriously enough to do some homework and actually, you know, try to come up with a true team and not just a, this is another thing I have to do today, then they shouldn't be voting. But I would think they would discuss with other writers and other players who they would consider too before placing their vote.
Yeah, the all-pro stuff to me means nothing when you're talking about receivers, tight ends, quarterbacks, running backs. I mean, you've got the numbers
there.
Yeah,
it's right there. I wouldn't even look at it.
But you do like a Tim for lineman?
Well, more so than anything? If you're talking about some sort of statistical way to measure impact of an offensive lineman or even a defensive lineman, inside linebacker, corner, you know, where there's no numbers to discern.
Well, that's why I like.
There's your quantifiable way.
Even defensive linemen and linebackers, you can do sacks, you can do interceptions, you could do pressures, passes defended. There is nothing for an offensive lineman. Okay, he hasn't allowed a sack all year, or, you know. That's why that's a position that I look at that for. I mean, none of it's an exact science, but I think that's as good a first-team all-pro vote for an offensive lineman to me is a good indication he's one of the best ones in the league. And if he has it 6-7 times, it's a good indication he's a Hall of Famer.
Well, it could be an indication of reputation, too. That's why I like the Pro Football Focus guys. At least they'll watch every game. It might not be the same guy in every game, but at least they're charting it. And I know they've gone through and given a grade to every player. And then they combine the whole league numbers, you know, together. Pouncey has 2 first-team All-Pros and 2 second-teams. So that's Hall of Fame credentials right there. He's a 4-time All-Pro. A couple more years of that, he'll probably be in. Is he one of the best centers to ever play the game? I don't know. He's pretty good. It seems like it could be a little flawed. Tell us what you think. SportsDoc@TribWeb.com. All right, now, Tim, I wanted to play your Fitzgerald Tucson interview here, but Mike Barker, executive producer, tells me it's so bad and every answer is 2 words, we should just play a clip from it.
We played the one clip that we need to play.
Oh, that was
let's,
it.
Let's please not call that my Fitzgerald Tucson interview.
Well, you're
attaching my name
interview
to that rubbish. Well, I was there. Yeah, there was 500 people there.
I was excited to hear from the guy. He could be a big story this week.
Okay, well, you could hear. Go ahead, play the one clip again, Mike, because this is all you need to know from Fitzgerald Tucson. I'm sorry, Fitz Tucson. He much prefers Fitz Tucson.
Oh, he does?
Go ahead, hit it, Mike.
I can be very electrifying and, like I said before, a very disciplined guy.
Okay, best clip. Done. Over. That's it. That's what you
Come
got.
Come on. I want 2 more minutes of that stuff.
Do you want 2 more minutes of I'm electrifying? Because that's the most electrifying clip you're going to get. And it's not my fault. It was a gangbang. There was literally 50 people around him with cameras and microphones. He hadn't spoken all week. And finally, he decided to talk to the media.
I want to know if the stage is too big for him. You know, how does he respond under the bright lights of the media?
Very quickly, apparently.
He was electrifying, apparently. He in Michigan in his career, Guy, had 31 catches in his career. He had 18 his senior year. And as I said before, only three in a game was his career high. Does it give you a little pause for what kind of a receiver he might be out of the backfield?
Well, I'm questioning more what kind of hands does he have. Usage doesn't always matter because it depends on offenses. You know, is that those numbers aren't electrifying, that's for sure.
But dependable.
Here's some other cuts from over there yesterday. Let's hear a little more Todd Haley. In particular, he talked about Martavis Bryant.
That would be a better choice, yes. This is a better read by you, Ken.
All right. And Ben calling him out, right, and whether he needs to step up or not. Here's Haley on Martavis' importance this week.
Yeah, I think last week was a difficult week for him, missing a couple days of practice, you know, then getting nicked up or, you know, fairly early in the game. And he wants to do well. He wants to be part of this. I think he's come in with a renewed focus and wants to show that he can be a part of helping us win.
And he was followed up on that by whether he had a talk with him. Ben obviously called him out. Did he find the need to talk to him, or his reaction to Ben calling him out?
I talk to him every week. With young guys like that, I think it's. You can't leave anything to chance or, you know, unknown whether guys are aware or not aware. So, you know, it's a constant process with some of these young guys. But, every week there's different coaching points and things that come up. You know, this week being a playoff week, I always kind of address the group as if I'm talking to all young guys, you know, because some of these guys don't know exactly what to expect. And at the same time, we tell them to make sure they're getting with a veteran that's been there and done that and can help lead them that way also.
I get more scared as the week goes on. Guy, your pessimism and your record against the spread has me spooked. Martavis's coin flip nature has me spooked. Fitzgerald Tucson has me spooked. Ben's interception pension of late has me spooked. I'm living in my fears as this week goes on. I like the Steelers a lot on Monday, less so here on a Friday. I guess I shouldn't turn to you for optimism.
Well, I get one out of three wrong, so that maybe that'll be the one.
Seriously, let's go down that path then, because of the four games that are taking place this weekend, which one do you think is the most difficult to call?
Seattle, Minnesota.
Really?
Yes.
All right, not against the spread. Forget the spread for a second.
Just
win or loss.
Probably Packers, Redskins, because I have no faith in either of those teams.
So you are more convinced the Steelers will lose than you
are
convinced.
I could pick a Packers, Redskins winner.
All right. I think this is the toughest one of the three by far. I mean, I really
think it's a tough one.
I have a lot of faith that the Chiefs are going to win. I have a lot of faith that the Seahawks are going to win. I'm pretty sure the Redskins are going to lose, more so than I am that the Packers will win. But I like the Packers, and I do not know about the Steeler game. Grudgingly in picking the Steelers. I'm basically picking the Steelers because I'm so unsure of the game, I might as well just not pick against the Steelers. That's what I'm doing.
One more from Haley. His reaction to Ben calling Martavis out and if whether you know he had a problem with him going public with it.
No, not at all. I mean, I think that's the leader of the team. And I think it shows growth in Ben and at the same time trust that he knows we need all these guys, and at the same time, he's just trying to get the most out of them all. He's not trying to break them down or, you know, because that's not going to do anybody good at this stage. You know, I think he trusts that these guys, are there for him, and he just wants the best out of them, much like we do.
This could be a signature game. I'm not kidding, for Bryant. If Bryant comes out and has a big game and responds – to what Ben said, it may be an indication that you're going to have a guy that you can count on in the future. And if he, you know, recoils and doesn't do much or drops a big pass, will both Bryant and Antonio Brown be on this team in 3 years? I'm not so sure. Could Bryant become your number one receiver if Antonio becomes too expensive or Lee wants to leave at the end of his contract? I think this is a very important point in his career that's been tarnished by the suspension this year. This has given you teases of greatness, and this is, I think this could be a turning point for him. I don't think it's that's too melodramatic.
Roll tape on that. Guy Junker
signature
uses phrase.
Signature game.
Could
game.
Be a signature game for one player, not for the team.
By the way, breaking news this hour, the Bengals have ruled out Andy Dalton. So he is not going to play, and that is a sure thing. Per Mike Garofalo, I see, one NFL reporter, but several others that are tweeting in. But to that point, because Ben has quote-unquote called him out, or as Haley described it, they're trying to get the most out of his guys, can't you see the post-game Saturday night, Martavis has a big game, and the Ben patting himself on the back for being the leader of this team and fire under Bryant. That
is absolutely.
Be, oh, my God. We've heard Ben rave about his play calling when things go right. This is like Ben the coach. Coach Ben knew what buttons to push for his guys.
What if he has a bad game, drops a bobbles a ball that ends up getting picked off? Well,
then it was Haley's fault.
Yeah, will Ben say, maybe I shouldn't have called him out in public?
Nope.
No.
That won't even be addressed.
It'll totally be just like it was after the 2008 Super Bowl. Who's laughing now, O-line? Remember, the O-line was always his guys. I talked to my guys. You know, that whole narrative that was spun that year when everybody's like, wow, this offensive line stinks, and they're leaving Roethlisberger out there to die, and he's somehow making all these plays with Santonio. My guys. He used that phrase all the time. I ride with my guys.
It's Trib Live Radio. We're brought to you by Team Spanos Group of Raymond James. We teased the Neil Walker stuff, Tim, before we take a quick pause here. Give us the thumbnail of what Neil was saying yesterday to get a little baseball fix in here.
Where was the interview, Tim?
He was on Madden yesterday. And from the tone of his voice, you could just tell he is no longer torn between leaving, and it's much more clear that he has turned the page, that he's... There was an angriness or an anger, a bitterness towards what had happened, what had transpired. I think like some of those wounds have started to scab over, and now it's about baseball in New York. And you could tell he was upset that he's not here. He still definitely wants to be a Pittsburgh Pirate. There's no doubt about it. He would have preferred to stay. But
was Mark picking at those scabs as best as he could?
Of course he was, yes. But I definitely got less of a tone of being morose about leaving and now an angst about why I'm not there. And, you know, he was pretty clear in saying that it was more or less determined when he got the offer that he got, or lack of an offer that he got, as spring training started this past year, that it was over. It was done.
That's a shame. I mean, if he would have signed a deal guy and moved to first base, that could have been a very nice fit and solution for this team.
And he reiterated he would have done that if it was not in a walk year. Because he wanted to see, I think the phrase that he used was, it's something I would have considered if there had been some consideration given to my situation approaching free agency, or words to that effect.
To me, it's the weirdest, both Walker and Huntington are very easy guys to interview. They may, Huntington may give you a lot of GM speak, but I think he does throw nuggets out there. And I think even one of the best listens of the week is Greg Brown's GM show on Sunday afternoons on the radio, because he does say things on there that he doesn't say elsewhere. And he's told Greg, if I'm going to sit and do this every week, I want to give you at least a piece of news or something. So that's what makes it so odd. And I said, going back to spring training last year, that Walker actually dodged me a couple of times. He had an excuse, something to do, which is totally unlike him. He finally did the interview and said, I don't want to talk about my contract. And when I talked about Huntington, you usually always up until the 11th hour is optimistic. He blurted out, said, well, it takes two sides to negotiate. There's definitely a hard-headedness in the situation, and I'm not sure. I think there's a little bit of it on both sides.
I think we've all seen it in our lives somewhere along the way where you like person X and you like person A, and person X and person A don't like each other.
Yeah, and you wonder why.
Well, his friends going out to a bar, or it's usually with chicks, let's face it. Like these two girls you run with, they don't get along, and then it always turns into drama. But
usually with ex-wives.
Yeah, there's that too. But in this
one
case,
one time you like both of them, but they don't care for each other.
In this case, like, I like Huntington. I like Walker. I think that they blew it with Walker. on a couple of different levels, but it's just the strategy behind letting him go for virtually nothing when they could so easily use him in season as a trade chip if Jung Ho comes back healthy. It's so obvious. You don't even want to pay the start of an arbitration contract on Neil. God, that's cheap. Jesus, is that cheap.
Yeah, it was the Jack Wilson thing all over again. You know, he's a better player than what Jack Wilson was. He's no Hall of Famer, right? He's not a great second baseman defensively. He had 6 years here. They were probably all above average, but not great years. They were
That was
good
something
years.
You could tell he resented, was the suggestion he's not a good defensive second baseman.
Yeah, he doesn't have the greatest range. I think he's as solid a guy as you can get, though. I mean, you could count on him. And his RBIs were – he had a lot of important hits. If I would go up and down that lineup, other than maybe even more so than Andrew McCutchen, if I needed a guy to come up in the seventh inning of a one-run game with a tying or lead go-ahead run on third and less than two outs, there's not a guy on that team I'd rather have up there.
The greatest contradiction that the Pirates have had this offseason is the two quotes from Huntington about Neil Walker or about the cleanup hitter situation. We don't see ourselves needing a traditional cleanup hitter. Remember, he said that on a couple of occasions now, right?
Yeah, but that goes against what Hurdle said at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Okay, but he has said that you know, we don't look at the need for a traditional cleanup hitter the same way that other teams define a cleanup hitter. Mm-hmm. But he will say, in basically the same breath, that Neil's production at first base isn't the same if he's a first baseman as opposed to a second baseman. That is a massive disconnect in theory. It doesn't matter where the production comes from. If you're getting the production, especially if you're a team that doesn't view a need for a cleanup hitter or a traditional view of how a first baseman should
hit. It's like the rules change because it's related to him.
Right, exactly. And that has bugged me more and more as we've gotten away from it. Every time the Walker conversation comes up, I now think of that. How adamant he was about, we don't need a real cleanup hitter, but you need real first base kind of production. Why? Well, if it doesn't matter for one, why does it matter for the other? Because there's a $10 million price tag attached to it?
Meanwhile, yes. he hit 23 home runs 2 years ago, right? That would work for a first baseman for me.
It's all about money, and it makes me think of, in a way...
You think Jaso and Morse combined for 23 home runs this year? I doubt it.
They feel if they can get 70% of the production for, 50% of the value, they're coming out ahead. They have an internal salary cap, and they've got to deal with it. And I think it's so cold-hearted in a way... I don't blame Huntington for a lot of it, Guy, but he's so cold and calculated with his approach. When it comes to a hometown player like this that people like, it really makes it tough to palate, It's like if this was just a non-Pittsburgh guy that was a run-of-the-mill second baseman, I think most people would understand it in a way.
Yeah, but I think also, though, that, his position, you need some of that calculate. You can't overpay a guy or make a mistake just because he's well-liked and he's from Pittsburgh either, and that's what the Walker bashers will say and even accuse us, because he's a nice guy and he's from here. We all like him better than what his talents actually are. I just think he's – and obviously he's a very likable guy. I don't understand – Huntington doesn't seem that cold and calculated with everyone else, even to the point of pointing ahead of time that I'll probably get what was his exact quote?
We're probably going to get killed for this.
We're probably going to get killed for this, yeah.
Yeah.
He understands that part. I just think that the guy produced enough that he was worth more to them than what they acted.
Especially at first base. I mean, why not pay the money you're paying Jaso and Morse to Neil and just have him stay there and play first for you? If you want Jung Ho as your second baseman, fine. Move Neil over. You'd get good production there.
But you don't even have to think of it all year. Just in the short term before
Young
comes back.
Yeah, it's a valuable chip. Trade for some of those coveted prospects that you like so much once Gong comes back and proves that he's okay, if you don't want him as your first baseman even. It's
right.
just to let it walk away and get nothing for him is the tough part.
Yeah, well, John.
And I don't even buy the cranky back. That back really hasn't been that much. I mean, what player doesn't have some cranky body part that wants, maybe that'll keep him from playing until he's 37. I don't know, but I don't think it's been bad enough. The arm issues with A.J. Burnett were greater than Walker's back problem, and they brought him back.
And if you gave away Charlie Morton for basically nothing anyway in the offseason, you could have held on to Morton, too, and paid some of that contract for the short term until you made the move with Neil to get another starting pitcher of John Neese's caliber, or Neese himself maybe even, and then you could have ditched Morton for your A pitcher at that point if you wanted to anyway.
Right. Pirates also signed a new right-handed reliever.
I'm telling you, man, on both those guys, I'm convinced they didn't want to wait until the middle of the season because what if they played well?
What if they played well?
What if we have to keep them and pay them? Oh, shit, then what?
Yeah, more so than even Neeson liking the value in some return. You're probably right. That would have been possible.
See, I couldn't do business that way. I would think, well, great, that means we're in a good position to either trade them for more or to maybe win the damn division.
But if you're in a pennant race, you can't trade him, right? Because then the fans would go crazy.
And that's what I'm thinking. They're thinking, oh, God, we don't want to pay Neil Walker $10 million. And what if he starts off and he's 280 and he's, you know, on pace for 25 homers or 20? We can't trade that. People will kill us then.
If he's producing like that, then why wouldn't you want to pay him?
Because they don't want to pay him. It's just the money.
The other mysterious quote, Tim, was that there was no connection between what they did with Walker and Kong's rehab. How can there not be?
There has to be.
They play the same position, and you're going to need one or the other by April 1st.
Goes back to it was over before the season began last year, right?
Yeah.
They both told each other to F off, and that was it. It was like nothing that happened last year was going
to
affect it.
Well, I tend to take more – I like both of these guys, like Tim said, but I tend to take Walker's side more in this. I mean, to be told a couple hours before your arbitration, here's one offer, take it or leave it, and we're going to arbitration. What kind of – that's not negotiating. What is it?
It's
indentured service.
It's bullshit.
Yeah. That'd be some bullshit right there.
I think it's one of Huntington's worst moves as GM. I think he's done a lot of good things. This one, I think he is really missing on, and has.
I think the whole off season has been that way, Ken, and that's why Pirate
defenders, with Pedro. Pedro's the opposite of Walker. None of us like dealing with him. He was kind of a joyless person. But I still think there's value, and even though nobody has signed him, and I understand. I think there's still value in a guy that can lead the league in home runs, that can still have show you the – there's something you have to be able to do with him than just say sayonara.
As time's gone on, I guess that one's – the sting has gone out of that one. Doesn't bother me. And the more I think about it, yeah, he probably would have been better to keep him than the other two guys that they have platooning, but the better option was Neil Walker. You should have seen that 2 years ago. And Josh Bell is too far away now. Like, I don't mind the bridge year if Bell's – but he's no slam dunk for next year.
Right, and that's why bridge year to me is a misapplied term that Pirate fans are more than willing to eat up right now. The phrase bridge year started to be used a bunch when the Colts tanked and sucked for luck because they knew what was coming. The phrase bridge year was used a bunch in the NBA the year that Jabari Parker and Wiggins came out. And there was going to be the massive glut of free agents that hit, where bad teams didn't bother making moves in an offseason because they were going to wait for the big fish to get into the pond the following year. The bridge was to getting somebody that you knew was a known commodity or a very likely to pay off commodity in luck. This is a bridge to what? Question marks.
Well, Glasnow, I think, is a sure thing, but that's it. You're right about the others, Tim. I mean, even Glasnow's not a sure thing, but in my mind, I've made him one. So if they have Glasnow and Cole, that's good. But Bell is, I mean, what's Bell at this point? He's 50-50. He could be Pedro part two.
Well, I try to give them the benefit of the doubt. And that a lot, I've, because of the 20 years of losing, most of the off-season stuff the last few years, I've viewed with great skepticism and didn't think it was going to work, and much more of it has than hasn't. And so I just hope that I'm not blindly saying, oh, he's done everything right, because he hasn't done everything right, but he has guided this team pretty well for 3 years, Huntington I'm talking about. So I'll give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, though, I see, but I'm not expecting much. I'm hardly even looking forward to going to spring training. It's usually the highlight of my year for something to cover. I just look at it and like, ugh.
Well, I'm sure when we get there, if we go, there'll be some good stories. They do have an interesting new group of bullpen arms. Huntington always puts together a good bullpen. They got another guy who throws hard yesterday, right?
Yeah.
This guy,
well, yes, but look at what cost. At what cost, Ken Laird?
Yeah, they dropped Guido Knutson. That
the
was
loss of Guido Knutson. You lost a night of your life looking at Guido Knutson tape from a AAA game. You'll never have that night back now. Never.
At least I still have Gobert.
Just the time spent trying to find out if it was Guido or Guido or Knutson or Knutson.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. Did I settle on that? I even forget what
it was. Guido. I know it was Guido.
Guido Knutson. Well, he was so bad in the bigs, like they probably just figured, you know, we got somebody better. This new Trey Haley was 4-4 last year with a 2.45 ERA, 60 Ks in 43 outings in the minors. Throws hard. He can hit 97 on the gun, apparently. So that's good. So you've got between him and Holdscomb and Caminero and Neftali Feliz and Nicasio and Scahill, you got all these hard throwers. I don't know if they can hit the glove, but they can throw hard.
Oh, the Lobster isn't a throw hard-throwing guy, right?
He's a lobber. So. He's a lefty lobber. That's exactly right.
He just looks like the Lobster. I don't know. I saw a picture of him in the paper in the Trib yesterday. And he looks like a guy you could call the Lobster. I don't know why. It struck me that way.
One more baseball nugget. I know it's football.
Better a lobster than a lobber.
I was looking up Jason Kendall's stuff yesterday.
Oh, no. So we've gone from Alan Faneca to Jason Kendall now?
Yes. Yes. We've regressed.
How many all-pro teams was he on?
Well, give me two minutes on this. Because, Guy, I know you had a good relationship with Kendall.
I did.
And you liked him. And
all based on the time I went to California to do the story on his rehab when he broke his ankle. And we spent some good time together. And ever after that, there was some good in Jason Kendall hitting in there. He could be a Jagoff, there's no question. I saw it to a lot of people, but not to me.
Now, he got two votes for the Hall of Fame, so that means he's out.
He caught more games than anybody in Pirate history, right?
I think so.
I believe he caught, yeah.
He caught a lot of games, which is really to his credit. That's what I was looking at. Like, on one hand, he had three All-Star appearances. He never won a Gold Glove. He never won a Silver Slugger. He never got a top 20 MVP vote ever. And you would think, I don't know, just your eyeball test, Guy. Was Jason Kendall a Hall of Famer to you?
No.
Like, his stats don't seem like that.
An All-Star player and for a while a face of the franchise and a very, you know, if you were voting for an all-time catcher for the Pirates, he'd be in consideration, I think. Manny Sanguin would probably get the vote. But you talk about a first base being a position of need for a long time for them now. Catcher was never one of their great spots either.
Oh, after Pena, right?
I don't know. I think I'd rather Sanguin and Pena. For about 3 years, I think Manny Sanguin was every bit as good as Johnny Bench.
Then I was looking at this write-up.
Defensively.
Jay Jaffe did a big write-up for Sports Illustrated, and here are some numbers that give you a little bit of pause. Kendall had 2,195 hits, fourth among players whose primary position was catcher in baseball history. Hmm. Pudge Rodriguez, Simmons, and Fisk. And he is, let's see.
So he had more hits than Johnny Bench?
I guess. I don't know how many hits Johnny Bench had, but now this, but maybe he didn't, though. Maybe, did Bench have 3,000 hits?
No.
Okay. His 183 stolen bases while playing catcher are the most for any backstop since 1914. Okay, now stolen bases aren't the end-all, be-all. But, you know, and this...
He was he was more of an athlete than a catcher. I think he had 10 touchdown passes in a high school football game one time.
He had about 150 more hits than Johnny Bench. Johnny Bench had 2,048 hits. You said 2,195 for Kendall?
2,195.
How many lifetime at-bats for Kendall? We have Bench's numbers up.
I know this. Johnny Bench had 389 home runs.
Yeah.
Kendall might have had 9.
Kendall had 75 home runs. So he was a light-hitting catcher.
What's Kendall's lifetime batting average?
288.
21 points higher than Johnny Bench's.
How about RBI?
744.
All right, 1376 for Bench. So, you know, I understand the impact of those hits from Jason Kendall. I mean, if we're talking, how many hoppers through the infield in Three River Stadium before he went to PNC Park? You know, and defensively, you said he never won a Gold Glove. He was probably never close, nor should he have been.
I think he was above average. I think he was pretty good defensive catcher. His collective WAR, if you want to go sabermetrics, 19th all-time at the catcher position, 41.5.
Yeah, I mean, those are some good comparable. I didn't think yesterday when, you know, you brought it up that he got a couple of votes that it was that outlandishly crazy. I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but I don't think at least bringing his name into a discussion about, especially with some of the things you point out, at a position where how many catchers get into the Hall of Fame unless they were home run hitters? Not many.
Right. But if you just look at his whole body of work, he's a pretty good player. I mean, he was a solid top 20-ish catcher baseball history-wise per some of these numbers. But
well, that was my – when I used to write a yearly column on why Mazeroski should be in the Hall of Fame, Total Baseball had him ranked the 75th best baseball player of all time in totality in everything that he did. And if everybody wanted to point out to a .269 career batting average or whatever it was, and not being much of a hitter, if you're they had him ranked the number one fielding second baseman ever and the 75th best baseball player ever. Well, that's Hall of Fame material to me.
Same with Ozzie Smith, right? It's like he was all defense.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the singles that he got, Kendall was exceptional for a catcher. Some of the stuff that he did because of his speed. I mean, his hits total, his batting average, his stolen bases were because he was fast. I mean, that play of him jumping over I think it was a Padres catcher, leaping over him and landing and scoring on the plate, showed what a tremendous athlete he was. Like I said, I still don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but I don't think it's outlandish to at least talk about his numbers, especially as it relates to the catching position.
All that said, I wouldn't have voted for him either. But
no, I wouldn't.
There are some things in there that give you pause that, hey, maybe, you know, as you say, he shouldn't have been just dismissed out of hand, as I did. All right, that's enough baseball minutia here for this Friday. Let's get some pick and pork going. Steelers-Bengals, top of the hour. Our playoff coverage brought to you by Goodrich & Geist, pursuing justice for real people, online at goodrichandgeist.com. It's the Giovanni's Pizza Hour and four NFL wildcard games, the preview. We'll do it next.